Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hello, I'm Stephen.
And I'm Anoush.
And in this week's New Statesman podcast, we talk about the oncoming Trump. We find out who Julia's backbencher of the week is. And we've got the latest on Theresa May's speech on what it means for the Labour Party. Plus, we ask, is it really true that if you're on the right, you can get away with any old... Bleep? So, Brexit.
We've found out that Brexit does actually mean Brexit, which we have been told ever since the beginning by our Prime Minister, Theresa May, when she made this big address, filling us in on her plans for her negotiations of Britain's departure from the European Union. It was sort of billed as a huge sort of surprise by the press, I think, that she was going to say that she was prepared to take Britain out of the single market, take it out of the customs union, and also out of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice. But it wasn't really a surprise, was it, Stephen?
No, I think... We've said this before, but one of the odd things about Brexit and the lobby in general is this way that something kind of becomes a meme in the parliamentary press gallery, and no amount of fact, it's kind of like the facts need to reach a critical mass before people accept that the meme is false. And she said her red lines were not going to be subject to the European Court of Justice, going to have control over our own borders. You cannot achieve those if you are in the single market. Yesterday she stood up and went, we're out of the single market, and we are... And she kind of then was like mumble on the customs union. It makes hardly any sense that the government is disgracing itself by rewriting its Israel policy to appease Donald Trump. But it would make even less sense of any of those things if we weren't planning to be outside of the customs union striking our own trade deals. Like, why would Boris Johnson be in India today talking about the importance of trade if we didn't think that was going to be a thing we would do?
Exactly, and why would there be a department for it?
Yeah.
For international trade? Because otherwise we wouldn't need one if we were going to stay in the customs union. And I imagine that she was being a little bit evasive about it because she's looking at the possibility of some kind of transition deal. I don't know whether you think that's dead in the water now.
I mean, I think that the difficulty with Theresa May, right, is it's difficult to work out which one of the three audiences that she has any given point of the speech is directed to, right? So there are some bits which are very clearly for a European audience. So the bit when she went, we don't want to destroy the EU.
Yeah.
And we will continue to have an active role in terms of security and defence, spying, the European arrest warrant, all of that jazz. And then we will walk away from a bad deal. That's for both audiences, right? It plays well to the right-wing press, but it's also about the fact that from a negotiating perspective, you probably get a slightly better deal if people think you're willing to walk away from it. Unfortunately, and this is a kind of classic example of the Brexit problem, then a lot of the really good Eurosceptic arguments are also arguments about why Brexit will be a nightmare. So the wording of Article 50 is basically designed to discourage you from leaving, which is, from a democratic perspective, not a great way to structure your constitution. However, because leaving on WTO terms is so bad for your economy, it's very hard to work out what deal you could be offered at the end of Article 50 that would be worse than WTO terms, right? So it's kind of one of these with the customs union, it's hard to work out who were those bits for. Were they for us? Were they for Europeans? Were they for Conservative MPs? Who knows?
Yeah, and I suppose maybe those bits that you're talking about that fall through the cracks in which audience are for, they might be the biggest revelation into sort of the gaps in Theresa May's thinking and where she hasn't actually made up her mind on what she's going to do about it yet, because she doesn't know how that will play to each of her different audiences that she has to appease. What I thought was quite interesting is the way that she seemed, she obviously had to convey confidence that she was going to get what she wants. But she was saying, oh, you know, we will be allowed some kind of access to the single market or some kind of tariff-free trade because it's the economically rational thing for the EU to do. Why does she assume that the EU should act in an economically rational way when she has made the least economically rational decision by putting control of immigration over this staying in the single market? That's what I want to know.
Yeah, I mean, I think, because in an odd way, I think it's very easy, particularly if you think Brexit was a bad decision, to ignore the various flavours of bad decision, right? Mm. And kind of in terms of the advantages of Brexit, right, it probably does make sense to try and leave the customs union to unlock these exciting trade deals. If you ignore the fact that there's a wave of anti-trade sentiment sweeping the developed world. However, it makes less sense to leave the single market, right? It only makes sense, exactly as you say, if you've decided something is more important than economic self-interest,
yes,
which is the ability to control your own borders. I also feel that the weird thing about this, why would Europe suffer damage in order to keep the political project on the road? It's like, have you guys met Greece? We know for a fact that the EU27 is willing to take on economic damage for political reasons. Mm. And of course, the unspoken thing in most of the press on... I'm never quite sure what the correct word to use for the rest of the UK, so I'm going to use the word mainland, and I know that's slightly freighted, and I apologise. The press on the mainland has not clued into the fact at all that if you leave the customs union, that means you have some form of border, either at trading ports in Ireland and in Northern Ireland with the UK, or you have a land border between the north and the south. Now, yes, everyone in Westminster, Belfast, in Dublin, in Brussels, across the EU, no one wants to return to borders. Everyone wants to find a solution. But sometimes just because everyone wants to find one doesn't mean that there is one. I'd quite like to find £1 million behind the back of my sofa. But, you know, but the chances of it actually being there don't go up because I really want it to be. And the idea of what a hard border is in Northern Ireland is much... Yeah, if Scotland went independent and you had a couple of trading posts and they checked the odd car, very few people would be like, oh, there's a hard border between us and Scotland. But if you had that in Northern Ireland, for obvious historical reasons, that would feel like a hard border. You know, the presence of customs checks and custom posts is going to be a target for anger and aggression and all sorts of problems. I can't think of anyone who'd want to work at these, which means they'll have to get the army to do it, which obviously becomes a problem again.
Yeah, and a hugely symbolic change as well in that region. And I think that people have forgotten about that. And Nicola Sturgeon, how do you feel that she's going to use that political sort of minefield for her own gain? Do you think that she's going to try and use that in order to make Scottish independence or a second shot at Scottish independence look a little bit more attractive to the rest of the UK?
I think you kind of... the difficulty for them, I think, is in an odd way... It makes the political case for doing... I don't know what you think, but it makes the political case for it feel a lot stronger to
me. Yeah, I think so as well.
England has done this crazy thing, at least as far as Scotland is concerned, this crazy thing to it, and it would prefer to escape it. However, because England is going to go through a period of some economic turmoil, to put it mildly, and England is Scotland's biggest external market, that makes the economics of independence more fraught than they were in 2014. But on the other hand, I mean, did you get sent up to Scotland?
I wasn't sent up to Scotland, no. Maybe second time round.
This was before I was at the NS. And it felt to me that one of the kind of factors was there was a sense that the Conservatives were not going to be in power forever. You know, they were in coalition. You know, Ed Miliband was possibly going to be Prime Minister.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel to me that there's a widespread sense in Scotland that Jeremy Corbyn is going to win the next election or that the Tories are going to be out of power anytime soon. So that is obviously a powerful factor. I think there are lots of reasons why I think I think she will have a lot of pressure to hold it, but they fear that if they hold two and lose two, then at that point their coalition starts to come unraveled. And they already are sort of struggling to hold together, you know, kind of the whole breadth of the independence movement under one banner anyway.
Yeah, it's the tension between losing it and losing it forever, and also not taking the prime opportunity to have a second referendum. I don't think they're going to have another situation where it looks like we've got decades of Tory government ahead of us, and we've had the EU referendum that's like driving against their political interests. I don't think they're going to have a sort of perfect storm of those factors to merit calling a second referendum, and also to merit calling one in the hope that they'll actually win it.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right.
And then in terms of the rest of Europe, how do you think that Theresa May's speech played to them?
I mean, so Der Spiegel had a comment piece today, which was Theresa May's speech, I want, which I think sums up how my pronunciation of my own language is pretty bad, and my Spanish is even worse. But so El País,
El País,
the kind of, yeah, the Spanish daily ran a very critical editorial of it today. It has been welcomed by European diplomats and officials because it is doable, isn't it? Right? It's, you know, parking how you may feel about the border control stuff. It's all stuff that you can achieve.
Mm.
She's not asking to have her cake and eat it too. She is asking for something you can imagine a semi-plausible deal being done. But the problem is, and Helen's not here, so she can't criticise you. It is like that old joke about, oh, how do you get to the Catholic Church? Well, I wouldn't have started from here kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you wanted to get a good deal from the EU, it probably wasn't a good idea to let your Home Secretary stand up and go, we'll have lists of foreign employees.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you are obviously kind of our friendly neighbourhood green watcher.
Yes.
What are the Greens making of this? Because obviously it's bad news politically, but it's a bit of an opportunity for them as well.
It's a big opportunity for them, particularly with the vacuum that that Labour have left in terms of opposing Brexit, actually. I think what they want to do is, and this was their endeavour from a few months back, is to position themselves as the pro-immigration party, the party that will stand up for migrants, which is actually what their mug said in a counter to Ed Miliband's notorious controls on immigration mug. I think they're having trouble having their voices heard because the Lib Dems seem to be occupying that space, and quite successfully. I think when we were watching the coverage of Theresa May's speech yesterday, it was quite clear that Tim Farron was the biggest voice in opposition to it and criticising her decisions and her speech. So I don't know whether or not you think that, I mean, you've reported a lot on the Lib Dems' success. I don't know whether you think they're pushing the Greens out of the picture on this.
Yeah, I mean, I think the interesting thing at the moment is, yeah, at the moment the Lib Dems are running the table as far as this is going. Labour's policy is basically to semi-agree with this idea of tariff-free access to the single market, which is effectively a meaningless phrase. Most of the barriers to trade with Europe are not about tariffs.
Mm.
They're about regulations, and they're about other aspects of single market membership. The Lib Dems are the only party with a large parliamentary presence. Well, I guess they are the largest party currently opposing all of it, from start to end, and they have a bigger national reach in terms of the places they can win than the Greens. The interesting opportunity for the Greens, I think, isn't the Lib Dems aren't running on an anti-immigration platform, but they're basically, we're pro the economic benefits of immigration in general. The Greens are in a position of, we are pro migrants.
Yes.
Which, that is more, I mean, obviously I also believe in the economic benefits of immigration, but to you and I, that's more of an attractive proposition. Like, it's not just, look, we, you know, they're a bit of a pain, but, you know, look at all these jobs they create.
Yeah.
It's an unambiguously pro-migrant platform.
I think it's more ideologically genuine, you know, the benefit of migration in itself, you know, as a force for social good. Whereas the Lib Dems, yeah, you're right, they're aligning themselves more with what I'm sure businesses are feeling now, which is there's going to be a huge economic impact if we're not allowed to have the migration that we had before. So, yes, I think they are occupying a unique space. I just don't think anyone's listening to them, yeah. I'm afraid.
I also think the interesting thing is, I don't know what you think about this, so I may have gone mad, but I actually feel as if Labour are weirdly now living off Jeremy Corbyn's reputation as far as this is concerned, right? They've actually moved towards where the Conservative position is. They are not really, other than some shadow ministers, a couple of backbenchers, Diane Abbott, obviously, most of them are not holding the line on immigration, right? They are not defending the right of people to come here. They have abandoned free movement. They've abandoned single market membership. But because Jeremy Corbyn has this reputation as being anti-racist, pro-migrant, all of the rest, they say something which is just actually quite right-wing. And a couple of people are like, oh, I don't like this. But they kind of go, oh, I'm sure he doesn't mean it.
Yeah.
And my instinct is, in an odd way, if your ambition for Labour is just to try and hold on to as much of the third of a vote, of, you know, just under a third of the vote Ned Miliband got, Jeremy Corbyn works quite well for that, at least at present, because most people who Labour voters who want an anti-immigration line don't know what Labour's migration line is because it's so confused. The fact then what you can make out of it is fairly pro what the Conservatives are doing sort of blunts that thing. But the people who are angry about, would be angry about that, are like, oh, but isn't Jeremy our guy?
Mm-hmm.
The question I have is, as we get closer to an election, as that, as the line gets repeated more, do a lot of the people who are currently, you know, do you, yeah, what do you think? It's like, you know.
No, I know what you mean. I think we've got a problem here in that Jeremy Corbyn has the reputation for being anti-racist, very left-wing, unfashionable on issues like immigration in this current time. So the only people, you know, who really like that are his core supporters. Is he going to lose them if the actual line from Labour, which is basically anti, it's basically the same as the Tories, if that actually gets through and overshadows Jeremy Corbyn's leadership? If that happens, then Labour has no voters at all, as far as I can tell, because I don't think that that message is going to get through to those seats that they're really worried about, which are on the whole Brexity and anti-immigration. So really what I think Labour should be doing is, maybe it's unfashionable, but maybe they should position themselves on the right side of history. You know, what is the point of Jeremy Corbyn unless he's a man of principle? His line on immigration is really muddy because he's obviously not that comfortable with it, but he thinks that that's what the party wants and that's what his MPs who are in a precarious position want and voters in the Labour heartlands, in inverted commas, want from Labour. But he doesn't really believe in it. So, what, you know, they might as well just cut their losses.
Yeah, I think it feels like a repeat of the, I mean, it is a repeat of the Ed strategy, yeah. Right? You just have someone saying things on immigration that they clearly don't believe,
yeah.
Looking faintly like they've been taken hostage while doing it. We know then that approach doesn't work. My instinct is the difficulty with where we are on immigration is it's a bit like the £12 billion of welfare cuts, right? People will vote for it until it happens, right? And then the second you're like, by the way, that means your tax credits. They're like, whoa, 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 I thought welfare was other people.
Mm.
And I think it's the same with immigration, right? There might be a majority to lower it until we lower it. But I don't think there's really a majority to get poorer. So I don't think that if Labour could somehow, if all that is missing from the current Labour Party is to be more mean about immigration and it got into office and it reduced immigration and everyone got poorer, people wouldn't thank the Labour Party. So it should at least be on the side of the thing which allows it to actually govern and redistribute and do all of the other things Labour presumably still wants to do. And yeah, if nothing else, because you say, as you say, when in 30 years we're going, oh, why is the pound so much lower than the dollar? Why can't we keep any of our promises to pensioners, etc., etc.? At least to be able to go, you know, in the time when it mattered, the Labour leadership did actually stand up for.
Exactly. I mean, they're polling so badly anyway, they're probably not going to win. So worrying about losing that election, yes, it is important that you want to try and win an election. But I think in the long term, like you say, their path to success is probably being on the right side of history. Most Tories know that this is, you know, this is a bit of a rubbish policy, leaving the single market.
I think that is the other thing. I mean, I think in terms of what Theresa May has been saying, the only way she can keep that promise is through leaving the single market. But the reason why it has become politically inevitable is the majority of Labour MPs and the Labour leadership decided they weren't going to defend it and they weren't going to go, but look, do you really want to do this? Do you really want to make everyone poorer?
Exactly. And we know that, I think there was some polling over the weekend that said now the majority of people would not be willing to take a financial hit for lowering immigration. So
yeah,
maybe that can shift as we realise how much money we're going to lose.
Well, on that slightly more optimistic note than usual.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for Backbencher of the Week with our Staggers editor, Julia Rampant. So, Julia, who is your Backbencher of the Week?
Well, I thought there could be only one winner this week, which is Michael Gove, because we thought we'd seen the last of him, and then he turned up in a golden lift and interviewed Donald Trump and managed to get a front page of the Times, which I think we can all agree is pretty disgusting starch 2017. and worse than that, his metaphors and use of the English language was pretty offensive on a Monday as well. I just thought, I'm sure that many of our listeners will have avidly read the interview, but just in case anyone forgot some of the best metaphors, I wanted to read you a few. So he says, with Mr. Trump, everything is on display in his glitzy golden man cave, from admiring profiles in magazines to Christmas cards from world leaders. And Gove says he's no Kissinger, but intelligence takes many forms. He also talks about Mr. Trump's conversation, which flows like a river in spate, reflecting the force of nature that is the man.
I actually quite like glitzy golden man cage.
Maybe
I'll be commissioning Michael Gove in the future. Yeah. If you're listening, yeah. Michael.
tune in. The interesting thing about it, of course, is obviously it's a massive scoop film for the Times. It's the result of months and months of them gradually softening and making their coverage of Trump more favourable. But the weird thing, of course, is that Trump always lies, right? So in an odd way, all of the kind of newsworthy things, and I guess the big story globally is him saying that NATO is obsolete, which must come as a bit of a shock if you live on its eastern border, and then the EU is going to fall apart, right?
Yes, and everyone's been saying since that interview came out and caused such a splash that, you know, Trump's comments about doing a trade deal with Britain, putting them first in line, which is sort of contrasting with what Barack Obama said, putting us at the back of the queue, means that Trump is a good thing for Brexit. I just don't really understand how anyone can possibly think that, because in the interview, like you mentioned, he was talking about how the EU is about to fall apart, how it's just a vehicle for Germany. I mean, insulting the EU... And Theresa May making herself look close to a world leader who's insulting the EU is certainly not going to put the leaders of the rest of the EU states who she has to negotiate with on her side. And also, I do think that there is a point in saying that Donald Trump's victory, his election, is bad news for Brexit, because the governments in EU states who have sort of populist parties who are sort of tugging at their elbows, that's going to make them more concerned about giving Britain a good deal than actually trying to negotiate with them.
And I think it's also undermining the British government to a certain extent, because it's the second time that Trump has shown this extreme favouritism to a Brexiteer. And first we had Nigel Farage, but Michael Gove, as far as the Tory party is concerned, he's also, you know, undesirable, sitting on the back benches. And it is a slight to Theresa May.
Yeah. The fascinating thing, I'm sure you've both picked up on this as well when you talk to MPs, particularly MPs from the Conservative Party, is the British right hasn't really, I think, clued into the fact that Trump is a different kind of president to one we've ever had before.
Yeah, I think there is a case for saying that the context in this country of UKIP gaining support over the past few years have almost made people feel like they understand what the Trump phenomenon is. It's like they think that it's America's UKIP. It's completely different from that. So I think there's a lot of right-wingers and just general members of the Tory party and the Labour party as well, who think, oh, well, you know, this is a sort of populist phenomenon. We know what that means. We know how to deal with it. We have UKIP in this country. And it's almost like they like the idea of someone sort of kicking up a bit of trouble. But I would say that it's completely different. I mean, there are parties in other countries that are also on the right or on the populist right who don't want to be associated with Donald Trump at all.
Yeah. And I think even within UKIP, there's a division of people who will publicly say they like Donald Trump and those who can see that actually this is not something they want to be allied to.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that a lot of the polling from people who say that they like Nigel Farage or people who are on the Brexit side of things, actually, Donald Trump doesn't have very popular ratings among those people. So it's not like if you like Nigel Farage or if you like Brexit and you want to leave, you're automatically going to be in favour of Donald Trump.
I think another there's a bit of evidence of this kind of self-deceiving Brexiteer view is Michael Gove gave Donald Trump his book, which I don't know if you remember it, Celsius 7-7.
Yeah.
But he apparently gave it saying, here's a guide on how to fight terrorism. So, I mean, he probably left that building feeling like he was influencing the next president, but somehow I doubt that the man who never reads books is going to finish it.
For listeners who can't see us, Stephen just really flinched then, by the way.
I think the sad thing is he will briefly have influenced him, because one of the traits of Trump's behaviour is he is incredibly influenced by the last person he spoke to. I mean, obviously the sad thing for Michael Gove is he will have spoken to other people. But I mean, I think there are lots of really intriguing bits in the write-up of the interview, not least the bit where he kind of goes like, oh, you know, parts of Europe were saying, oh, you know, Ronald Reagan is a dangerous Russian cowboy, George W. Bush is a, you know, etc. And you kind of think, well, okay, that is true. However, the parts of sort of the European establishment or the Democratic left which are uneasy about Trump were on the whole bits which might have been opposed to Ronald Reagan, but they very much weren't the same group of... It does feel there's a kind of type of person on the British right who's like, oh, the left, a term that they've decided applies to, you know, everyone from Che Guevara all the way to, you know, Tony Blair. They are always critical of US presidents, and you kind of go, well, there's an interesting unanimity. I mean, when you have Bill Kristol, an American neoconservative, going, isn't it a bit terrifying that Trump has attacked John Lewis, not the department store, but a black congressman, more than he has ever attacked Vladimir Putin? You'd think the light would start to go off. But I think the problem with the fact that a lot of people have gone, oh, 2016 was awful because of Brexit and Trump, means in the minds of some Brexiteers, you've got to defend Trump because you've got to defend Brexit.
That's the thing.
And in the minds of some people on the left, they are equivalently bad. It's like Brexit might just make our pensions smaller. It could equally make them larger. Trump might mean we don't need our pensions. And on that cheery note. And now it's time for You Ask Us, a section in which you ask us something. Helen is, of course, away, which means you do not get that jingle thing. We had one question that a lot of people asked us on the back of last week. I'm not going to repeat the word I used because it rocked our family-friendly rating slightly. But can you get away with any old...
Cobblers,
if you are on the right. Triggered, of course, by the fact that the DUP has literally been found to have not noticed that they were running a scheme where they literally paid people to set money on fire. and it turns out this is fine. I mean, at least it's fine as far as, you know, the government kind of go, oh, we don't want disunity. But no one... The interesting thing is, obviously, no one wants disunity in Northern Ireland. However, I find it strange that no one has said, do you know what we also don't want, though? You to burn the block grant. You to literally burn the money you've been given.
Well, this is the thing that, you know, if you're right wing, this is the thing you always criticise the left for doing, for burning money, for throwing money away, for wasting money, for wanting a big, wasteful, bureaucratic, creaking old state, and they want to make it smaller and more streamlined. So whenever the right waste money or do anything like this, they can get away with it. Like, my theory is that if we ever wanted to get rid of Trident, I know that's a money-making, that would be hugely money-saving, so it's slightly different. If we wanted to get rid of Trident, the only people who could do it would be the Tories, because, again, the left are always criticised for, you know, being not sticking up for Britain and not wanting to protect our country and being anti-defence. So I think the right can get away with all sorts of different things just because of the general criticisms that the left always have levelled at them.
I think the left does play on a higher difficulty setting, particularly in the UK. We actually have a really good metric of what happens when you ask the centre-right to play on the same difficulty standard as the left. It was called Britain Stronger in Europe.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't work out so well. And I think Britain Stronger in Europe had a good message, but it didn't get amplified by... Yeah, if you compare the level of credence with which Cameron's Ed Miliband will go into coalition with the SNP and eat your baby was given compared to the credence that Angela Merkel going, look, there's not a better deal to be had by voting out, was given, you kind of see the different levels than the right and the left play for. Or with Corbyn and Trump, you know, Trump is an actual present threat to NATO, the security of the Western order, except all of that kind of thing. Corbyn's spokesman goes, one of the things we would like to de-escalate is the presence of soldiers on the Estonian border. Now, you can say then, does Jeremy privately sympathise more with Russia than is really fair in terms of what's going on in that region? Sure thing, maybe. But actually, in terms of what his spokesman said, the gap is quite large, right? Mm. But when you have a situation in which Donald Trump is saying NATO is obsolete, the number of things you have to be optimistic about to be concerned about Jeremy Corbyn's effect on NATO. Like, one, you've got to think Labour are somehow going to find a way to win back Scotland or, you know, really posh parts of England, neither of which look all that likely. Two, you've got to think that NATO is going to make it till 2020, which just feels like it just, you know, it's why I'm, whenever someone goes, oh, we need to learn from Vote Leave, we need to learn from Trump, I kind of feel like if lesson one is have a press which is much less critical of you, it's not really a useful lesson.
No, I know. Can you imagine if any leading figure on the left had said, I think NATO's obsolete? Can you imagine the headlines there?
Yeah. We would just go on and on. Or, you know, Theresa May saying briefing wasn't helpful, right, and then journalists were harming Britain. Can you imagine if Ed Miliband had said, you know, we're not going to get a great result from this referendum if the papers are harping on, right? There would be three editorials today about how he was a threat to the free expression of the press.
Yeah, exactly. It's only the right that can get away with certain things. I remember you had a very good quote during the referendum campaign from a Tory who was saying, is this what it feels like to be losing? Or is this what it feels like to be on the losing side?
This is what it's like all the time.
Yeah.
And I was like, mm-hmm. And I think there are a couple of reasons for this. One, yes, obviously there is the fact that mostly if you are able to afford to own a major newspaper, you mostly have quite a lot of money and you don't like the idea of people taking that money. There is a structural reason why the press tends to the right. I also do think there is, in general, a broader problem with the way we on the left approach political debate, discourse, and the way we relate to other bits of the left.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that, kind of, it does feel like you're never really thanked for saying anything nice about another bit of any bit of the left. If you say something nice about Corbyn, then, even if it's something like, so, you know, if you say something like, he has got much better at PMQs, right? Mm. And I do think, actually, other than that first PMQs against May, I think he's probably won every single one of them. Or draw, but he's unbeaten against May on quite a long record now. You go, Jeremy Corbyn hasn't lost a PMQ since May on his first time, and you get eight people going, but of course PMQs doesn't matter and he's going to lose all of our seats. And you just think, guys, can you not, like, notice one good thing he's done without...
Exactly. And also, those are probably the same people who would be congratulating May on how wonderful her first PMQs was and lamenting how terrible Jeremy Corbyn was, even though they're on the left.
But you
say you're right, you don't get thanked, you don't get congratulated anytime you do something good.
Because you say that, and then you say, like, oh, he's done well. And then, instantly about eight people are just like, he's always been brilliant, you neoliberal. And you just kind of think, and you think, that's no wonder people move to the right when they're older. It just must be so rewarding.
What?
Just so nice to have people say nice things about you when you praise their team.
Yeah, like, I wonder why this is. Is it because on the left, you will always be a hypocrite in some way because you subscribe to certain principles? Whereas on the right, you do subscribe to certain principles, but you don't really ever get called out for being a hypocrite. You know, you can send your children to private school and do all sorts of things, and you don't ever, ever get called out for it, even if you're, you know, a government minister or someone who does work, you know, for the state. Whereas on the left, you can never do things like that without having chunks taken out of you.
Oh yeah, I mean, it is like that old thing about, like, the right seeks converts, the left seeks traitors. And I do think it is that if your sort of foundational belief, and obviously we can have another entirely other podcast about whether or not left free right was a useful dividing, but seeing as the central divide is, do you think that the state can do things? Yes, and what are the things you want it to do, right? And the second you're into that thing of you're having an argument about principles and outcomes, but if you have an essential philosophy of, look, there are lots of things where the state needs to keep its beak out, the minimum of interference, strong security, you know, et cetera, infrastructure maybe, it's less fraught. Because the one issue I think where the right behaves like the left is Europe. Mm. Why? Because there is a weird principle thing at stake.
Yeah. been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Anoush Shakelian, and Stephen Bush. Our music is by the Underscore Orchestra, licensed under Creative Commons. If you want more in-depth opinion pieces on the subjects we've been discussing today, then check out our website.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.